Hey guys, I just wanted to give you a little background on this episode. I recently had the opportunity to go to Seattle for a conference, and while I was there, I thought I would try to reach out to James Harleman, who has been an unintentional mentor to me here with what I do at Real World Theology. It was a shot in the dark, but I sent him an email with the idea of interviewing him for the podcast while I was out there, and even though I had a very small window, he and his wife were very gracious and generous with their time to have the wife and I over and chat about movies, comics, theology, and their cat. So this interview is just a little different from what we have done to this point, but I think it's just as valuable. So listen, enjoy, and if you like what you hear, make sure you check out what James is doing, and I will link all the ways you can get up with him in the show notes on the blog over at realworldtheology.com. Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture and to encourage viewers to recognize that entertainment is not mindless. And you're good, and I'm good. So, welcome to this special edition of Real-World Theology. I am Fizz, your host. This week, instead of having a movie that we're talking about, I actually have James Harleman here. I am in Seattle visiting, not just for him, but it was a highlight, a perk, if you will. He is a writer, author, creator, contributor at the website Cinemagogue, and he is actually one of the guys who inspired Real World Theology. So if you like what you have been hearing here, he is partially to thank and or to blame, I guess. Depending on how you want to. So thanks for taking the time. I really do appreciate you taking time out of your schedule to do this, James.
Well, it's nice to know that I'm a very special episode. And it's also nice to know that I'm offended you didn't just come out for me.
Well, I would have if we had teleporters, if we all lived in the Star Trek universe, which I think you and I probably would prefer to live in.
Well, I do.
You do have a very nice inflatable captain's chair that I have not sat in because I would be too afraid. I don't think I haven't won the chair yet. I haven't earned it.
Close.
But
promotion's coming.
I appreciate it. So like I said, you have you've kind of inspired a lot of what I do here, and to tell people who might not know what that is, not necessarily what I do, but what you do, just kind of give us a general idea of what you do when it comes to film and theology, what you like to do, you know, what that's about, why it's important yet, but just what you do.
Well, I like watching movies. That's been since I was a little kid. There's an old Star Trek episode called The City on the Edge of Forever, where there's this portal where you can look through into all these different times and worlds. I know kids that know Captain Kirk now have no idea what happened in the 60s with that. But I think the first time I went to this little Valley 6 drive-in just outside Seattle, we were at a drive-in watching a terrible movie, The Shaggy D.A., the old one. But the whole time, my brother and I were turned around in the back seat watching on another screen, which we couldn't even hear the sounds, but it was Star Wars. And there was this hunger and desire, and there was this massive excitement to get back and to see that at some point. But just at that drive-in, here you are sitting in a parked car looking across the landscape, and there's these big, giant, towering monoliths, like, showing portals to other worlds. And that, I think that was probably just an early idea that got me into stories. I mean, I was pretty ravenous as a kid with books, too.
Mm-hmm.
And probably more. We were poor. My dad was a public school teacher, so there was a lot more television than movies. That was a very... That became the special occasion. Television was the normal food. Movies were a night out dining and consuming story. And that motivated me. I would write a lot of stories. In fifth grade, I had an overly indulgent teacher who would let me, I would write a story, which usually parodied some episode of the A-Team or some movie that we'd seen the week before, just involving me and my schoolmates.
Early fan fiction?
Yeah, it was the early 70s version of fan fiction. But I changed all the names and just plagiarized the heck out of whatever it was to hopefully disguise it. And then I would read it to the class, and she actually would let me get up in class. So I had an audience, and I was giving story to people, or at least my interpretation of story. And so a lot of the foundations for what would later come to be film and theology, I think are there. I mean, then later I fell in love with one story, a biggest overarching story, just the story of the gospel, which I think encompasses everything in all of us. And so then beginning to take that and all the English I'd had in college and just begin to look at some English 101 and even the basic idea that stories do reduce, stories break down. There's some basic ideas we're telling. When even a cheesy movie like The Amazing Spider-Man can bring out the fact that there's only one story and the premise of the story is, who am I? Mm-hmm. It's like even some of our least, even films that aren't deep are toying with the idea that there are deep underpinnings behind all stories. And that grabbed me in college and carried into then my Christendom. And I wanted to marry the two because we use this idea that we have the greatest story ever told. If it's the greatest, then you'd think every other story somehow approximates or tries to reach up and touch on. I mean, everything's trying to be the greatest, mm-hmm. or trying to give us something. And so like what are the ties that bind us was one of the ideas that captivated me at an early age. And so more than, that's good for that. I mean, that's...
Well, I mean, that gives us the background, and I think that's a good setting for, I think, where we're going. You used a phrase that I have blatantly plagiarized by your grace. So that says movie theaters are modern day pulpits. And can you just talk a little bit about like why it's important not to just go to a movie theater and turn your brain off?
Well, I let you pillage that because I really just pillaged it from Martin Scorsese. So
there you go.
And I think what he actually said was that that cinema was the modern day church. So, and that was his idea. He went on to elaborate. You know, you get what's the one place you'll get a Buddhist, a Hindu, a Christian, and all these different people. They huddle together, look forward, and have this shared parable or experience. And all go out then speaking about what it might have informed them. And so for him, it was very real. So some of the filmmakers that were crafting things before I was watching anything more than the pretty pictures, mm-hmm. already had this idea that the 20th century really changed things. And so I was fascinated by that because you think about how many people were literate before the last few centuries, how many people then had access to many stories or maybe a few magazines. You think of a country or a pioneer kid, they might have a few tales mom or dad would tell. The stories were the number and even the ability to find them yourself, not being literate culture, mm-hmm. it was very limiting. So now we've just become so oversaturated and it's everywhere. And I think people do like those portals, escape into stories that has become the medication that has become, before we turn to pills, we turn to stories. Before we get our catharsis, just like the old Greeks would from the time in the theater, you experience someone else's pain, the empathy, it gives you a sense of satisfaction. You go home and face your workday. And so it then becomes a pretty powerful vehicle. If it's what everybody's spending their money on, if we're going to the arena, not to watch two guys club each other or get fed to lions, but we're going to the arena altogether to then have this life experience of other people that somehow makes us feel good or bad or up or down. That's like a fire and brimstone sermon. We leave feeling that the world's crap, or we leave feeling that there's hope. And that's a huge power. And all you gotta do is look at the Bible. Jesus is disguising teaching as stories about people and meeting them where they live. So even before there was movies, just storytelling has always been a predominant theme in teaching itself. And so, I think pastors who stick to bullet points have actually, the church has lost something.
Yeah.
And the reason, and that's the negative side then to sort of maybe lean into the church and stick a fork in it is just to say there used to be, storytelling used to be one of the modes of teaching. And I think post-Enlightenment, the church has followed a mode where it's become more bullet points and education and systems and coming up with acronyms to remember mm-hmm. Christian ideas and concepts. And we've gotten more and more away from story. And 20th century then, film and cinema and television have come in to sort of sweep us with story, but, well, not with the same guide that, that Christendom might employ, yeah. And not with the same, and probably not even one guiding force. A yeah. bunch of people with lots of different motivations, whether it's money or whether they do have some kind of political agendas and worldview ideas that they are trying to put in a digestible fashion.
Well, when I hear you talk about story, it reminds me of one of my favorite quotes from Tim Keller. He says that, you know, without a story, facts are meaningless. Like they don't really compel us to do anything. Mm-hmm. And he typically uses the September 11th, you know, from, mm-hmm. you know, a plane hit a building. That's a fact. You know, but when you spin it into a narrative, when you tell that story, you can motivate people to sadness, to, you know, empathy, to anger, mm-hmm. And really start moving things. And it's how we use that story. And that's one of the things that I've really kind of caught on with. But I guess I know to a certain degree why I do what I do. But why would you say that you've written an entire book, you know, about this? So obviously it's important to you. What do you hope to accomplish through Cinema Guy? I mean, like who's your audience? Like what, you know, if everything went just like you planned it, which you probably don't have a specific plan, you know, what would you hope would happen?
What would I hope would happen? My initial goal was to re-educate Christians. My initial audience, I think, was the church, just because it was an environment I came back into and an audience that I was sitting amidst. And so that was the first thing. It's like, why can't anybody see what I see? Which is, that's where a lot of our motivation comes from, no matter mm-hmm. what it is. But it occurred to me, and it was, you know, it was one of those things where one of my mentors and pastors had zero connection between the two things. Like he would go enjoy his film, and then he would enjoy his theology, and not questioning his relationship, spiritual walk or his faith in general. I think he knew God and loved God, but movies was almost a dirty little secret, a thing you do on the side, this compartmentalized slice of something that has no relation to worship. And, you know, when I read verses in my Bible that say, whatever you do, eat, drink, go to a movie, have a cup of coffee, still trying to figure out, go to the bathroom. You know, it's just like, whatever you do, do it to the glory of God. So a couple of those seem kind of tricky. But if I actually believe that, and if there's a part of me that say, if this is giving me joy, like there has to be a way that's good. Even if parts of it are appealing to things that are negative, parts of this have to be appealing to things that are built into me by my creator. It's like, what are those? Say, God's a storyteller. It's a story, like at a base level, then there's some basis for joy. It's like, how do we merge those two things back together so that Christians don't have to treat movies like the dirty little secret or fear them, but can just embrace them? But what I found out was, as I began to do that, I inadvertently stumbled onto people who, you know, didn't love the God that I knew, but were fascinated by the idea of story and what it told us about an underpinning story in our lives. It was totally unanticipated that I have a friend who was an atheist and became a Christian because of that. So I was surprised. Mm-hmm. The first time I knew somebody who was like, you know what, I believe life all does have a story and a storyteller. And I was blown away. So that was, I feel loved and blessed by the God of the universe that suddenly, even just that one story, just like somebody went from not believing our cosmos has a storyteller and actually became a lover of the God that I know and live for. It's that was sort of an unintended consequence that yeah. then I did that. It's like, well, how can I be more intentional in this? How can I even begin to make sure that I'm not just speaking so that those with a Christian ear are hearing, that I'm having a conversation that could be enjoyed by more? And that's what Jesus would do. Somehow he would frame the conversation in a way that anybody could join in. And he's probably going to get to, what he holds dear, but everybody could feel comfortable there. And so that then opened that up. And then the third step was then a couple filmmakers and or aspiring filmmakers and potential screenwriters were like, this is helping formulate our worldview as we dive into doing this. It's like that, Well, then I just sort of, you know, I had to change my pants. So it's like I've written one book. I'm not published in the realms of fiction or like those are things that I've admired, and I wanted to make people understand they could admire them in ways that are wholesome, holistic, and written, and actually redeem aspects of stories and create the provocation for the conversation so that we have. But to actually just have that staggering notion that, oh wow, people are thinking about the types of story craft and underpinnings that I'm talking about and trying to take them into the media and the field. But I guess that really would be my ultimate goal, that a generation that's younger than me would go and far surpass me and not just take the ideas and teach the principles, but actually be able to put them into practice as they're filtering into the Hollywood scene, as they're writing the next generation's books, to see a little more of somewhere between a C.S. Lewis and a Tolkien style of writing. Because I do tend to lean... Lewis very much has a one-for-one analogy in a lot of ways. Tolkien plays with concepts that I think draw in a larger audience without some of the skepticism. And so I think both have been great pivotal works of fiction, but I think Tolkien's have engaged a broader audience who can't deny where the source of an inspiration of much of it came from.
Yeah.
But let's it fit in there. So I've rambled again.
Well, I mean, it's answering the question still. I mean, like, you're talking about the difference between going to a movie and seeing something that is made for Christians,
mm-hmm.
that has a very blatant, overt narrative. And the opposite side of it is writing something where something is woven in so deeply that you almost can't deny, but you wouldn't call it like a Christian movie. Right? So when people hear what you do, or when you try to engage people and start, or you try to get to someone to come to like a synagogue event, do they basically just assume that you're doing some kind of like Focus on the Family like event? Like, oh, they're going to come and we're going to see a movie that's definitely positive and I can bring my kids to. Like, do you run into that a lot?
Only until they look at the playbill, right? When they see we're showing Paranormal Activity, then it's like, what? This can't possibly be happening in a church setting. We did The Exorcist one time, and I admittedly wasn't. I apologize because I personally was so disturbed by one element, one scene that I asked them to indulge me and let me skip it. But the audience is very forgiving. So, but otherwise, we've shown everything pretty much unedited. So that actually usually shocks the Christians more than non-Christians. Yeah. Non-Christians is, if you don't love Jesus, be like, hey, we're going to watch the movie, and the bill says Film and Theology, and it's like, well, okay. There's no bait and switch. I think, you know, like something's coming on the back of it, and maybe they just think going to kind of come up and give a basic gospel message. But I think sometimes I and other Christians, like, we always feel like we have to put all of our power into one punch. It's mm-hmm. like, the idea is I've been put on this planet for a lifetime, and I want to share ideas that are bigger than my lifetime. I kind of want to just experience and engage the ideas that come up in the context of the film. I mean, and it's crazy where they come up. You know, like, we take for granted little things, like when I woke up yesterday and I'm just looking at the beautiful day, and it's like, thank the maker comes into my brain, which mm-hmm. is something that a robot says, C-3PO. Why does a robot say thank the maker? Well, he had a maker. Well, he obviously had a maker because he's a robot. But that's a little thing stuck in a five-year-old kid's head where you exclaim thanking your maker. And mm-hmm. and what do you do with that? Like, those things don't sit idly in a culture, particularly in impressionable children's minds. Like, that I personally grew up always believing that I had a maker. As a very young age, that childlike faith, I believed I had a maker. And honestly, looking back, I don't know if that was because of Sunday school or Star Wars. Like where did some of those initial thoughts come from? If I believe that I have a maker who can break through anywhere, anytime, in an imminent way, then he's permeating all of those things. And if you read your Bible, he tends to pop out in unexpected places. Mm-hmm. And he's not always showing up in the synagogue or the church building. And we should be. I think Christians are, for Christians on this side of a fence, forgotten that that's the way he often reveals himself. And so if something doesn't have a wholesome Christian stamp on it, we freak out. We forget that he shows up in bizarre and sometimes scary and eerie circumstances, talking animals and you know, angels appearing with a spear and hosts of heaven on hillsides that just open up someone's eyes and either make them terrified or make them feel very secure. And so where can he be showing up that we're not paying attention? Because it'd be cool if we were there with those people in those stories and experiences and able to and say aha with them and maybe take that to the next phase. But everybody thinks that every time I have a conversation about anything related to the big story that I believe, I somehow have to get all of that story crammed down their throat. Like, how about we just start with a story that deals with destiny and figure out if we think there is any guiding hand?
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's great conversation number one.
Well, that's talking about the meta narrative in general. I mean, you're starting to, like, you know, think a couple stages ahead of or above everyone else. You're not simply saying, oh, well, he shot a guy. Is that bad or good? You know, you're saying, like, why do we believe there's justice in the world? Or, you know, or why do we long for justice? And I love your examples from the Bible itself, because I think there are very few stories in the Bible that are going to be rated G, that are for all ages. Yet we let children, or we encourage children to read the Bible. We encourage them to memorize the stories and memorize the lessons they're teaching. Yet we won't let them, you know, we're like, oh, PG? Maybe not to your certain age. And given it's not like we're, PG movies are obviously not as hopefully purely intentional as the Bible is. But you also mentioned going in the completely opposite direction, horror films, and even they have something that we can take from them. So just take us, if you would, I didn't put this in the notes or anything, but like, you know, just take people who might have been taken aback by that thought that you can watch The Exorcist and grow closer or in your understanding of God or your understanding of theology in general. Like, where would you go with that?
I am biased, and so I think I've come through a circle, because in high school I was fascinated with horror movies for all the wrong reasons, and so it's I would never deny there's lots of bad things to come out of a horror movie. However, dry drama conversations about the human condition apart from God, I'm not sure that they yield any better results. Somebody could go shoot up a school just because they've determined that, you know, because of their nihilistic attitudes in characters in a perfectly normal drama. You could pick up and run with that. So I think there is danger in horror films. They certainly could titillate. And in fact, there is a trend in some of the, you know, if you want to take a pot shot at the paranormal romance and some of the stuff we have today, where there seems the paranormal sides tend to have nothing but attractive people behind them.
Yeah,
I'm not sure those are horror movies. One,
I mean, only if you have to watch them, right?
Yeah, that's the horror. So, what do we do with a horror movie? I think that somewhere in the last few centuries, we lost a principle. I mean, we sort of moved away from some of the Grimm's fairy tales and using scary stories to make sure children didn't sneak out of the house at night and wander into the woods, right? There was a tradition in culture, not just Christendom, where where scary stories were told to children to enforce the basic principles. Say, you know, don't go in the woods alone. Don't accept candy from strangers. We sort of had the scared straight mentality. And over the last few centuries, we moved further and further away from that to where we just want to create safe, sheltered environments and wait till later times in life to talk about death and talk about those things. And While neither of those are perfect, we lost the idea somewhere in Christendom then that the horror movie had any value. And in fact, then it was like, it's putting fear into our hearts and we shouldn't fear anything but God. So it has to be bad. And then in fact, if it's talking about demons, there must be demons somehow behind it. I remember The Exorcist came out. Some prominent teachers and theologians said there were demons in the celluloid, which... Now it's on Blu-ray. Maybe it's safe. I don't know. Like do they keep jumping from medium to medium? Is it like The Ring? We'll move from VHS tape to DVD. those ideas are, I mean, there's something to be feared about that when it's handled inappropriately or handled in a way that make kids want to go out and play with that. But when the stories usually involve negative consequences, it's hearkening back to the ancient Grimm's fairy tales. It's hearkening back to some of the ancient and dark stories to where, wait a minute, this is like those driving movies you watched at 15 during Driver's Ed where you have the horrible accident. Like this, somebody plays with the occult, somebody gets hurt. And to not have those stories in our culture transmits a message that if I encounter no stories that involve the occult, for good or bad, kind of makes me think I'm just in a world where there is no spiritual side. There is no demons. If stories reinforce our realities if that's what they exist in culture. I mean, we watch our sitcoms with our friends and we pick up little tidbits on how to interact with our friends and neighbors, or maybe we watch the Homer Simpson and all the things what we shouldn't do.
Yeah.
All the ways we get it wrong. And we watch all these things in our stories. If none of our stories include a spiritual side of life and none of them include a dangerous side of that, then we're almost, what we're reinforcing is it doesn't exist. Like, we're actually saying the super, like if I don't like Supernatural, because we shouldn't have a show that deals with the supernatural. Mm-hmm. So all we're going to deal with is a concrete world where there's no supernatural. Well, that seems to be reinforcing an unbiblical idea. So how do we put these, we ought to have these stories. I should expect every culture that has people in it that believe there's a spiritual side of life, and not just that it's all happy clappy spiritual side, but there's dark, powerful, malevolent forces that, apart from God, I can't beat. Those stories ought to have their place. And they've been acceptable somewhere. I remember watching The Twilight Zone with my dad.
Mm-hmm.
Growing up in the church, The Twilight Zone is acceptable. Maybe because it wasn't bloody, but some of those ideas were terrifying.
Way worse than, like, gore.
Yeah, and some of those have resurfaced now. Like, we've had PG-13 movies like The Ring, PG-13. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't have to have blood. So if the primary concern was blood, well, that's another conversation. Because, again, there's so much blood in the Bible, you're drowning in it before you finish. Yeah. So if there's an aversion to blood, I'm not sure I get that when I contrast it with my Bible. And if there's an aversion to dealing with the demonic, it's like, no, we should have great stories. And so the fear is, of course, that they're not being done accurately. And that's, well, I get that.
Or but at least again, without follow-up, maybe?
Yeah, and that's just it, too. I actually did read movie The Conjuring, just came out a little bit ago. I loved it, but one critique actually came out that it's the equivalent of a fire and brimstone sermon. You know, it's just like there's demons are bad, watch out for demons, the end. You know, it's like,
did you watch the movie?
Right, there's certainly no explicit, there's no explicit explanation of grace or really how you would be in a relationship that could overpower those things.
Mm-hmm.
It's certainly not detailed, so that I think there's also an idea that every story has to, again, be absolutely comprehensive or it has no value. And I run all the way back to Jesus' storytelling. And he would tell a story. Some people seemed to get it. Some people would not know what he's talking about. And then he'd go off with his 12 guys. And then he'd follow it up with some more explanation and explain it to them.
Everyone was always talking about it, no matter what. Whether they got it or not, everyone was talking about it.
Yeah, everybody's talking about
it. Just now when people leave theaters, everyone's talking about the movie.
Yeah. And so, I mean, the story is act one. I don't know if you like, did you see Unbreakable?
I did see Unbreakable.
You like Unbreakable?
Not as much as some people I know.
Okay. All right. The one thing that I thought was a fascinating concept was that M. Night Shyamalan, I have to throw up a little in my mouth now when I say it's just sad. I mean, like,
it started out so strong and he's just...
Breakable. Yeah, he was breakable. But in that, he said he wanted to make a superhero movie. He wanted to make an entire film that was about act one. And I liked that in concept. So you're right. It's act one. It really just is. It's what you would normally see in the first third of a Spider-Man movie or the first third of any other superhero movies. Like, let's just take the time to really contemplate what act one would be about. And in some ways, that's what I think every story should be built to be. We should treat stories like act one or two. Like, Act 3 is the conversation that happens after.
Yeah.
Like, Act 3, the climax is conversation. And that, people forget that. It's, you know, if the film's the quarterback, I still got to catch the ball. That's my lame attempt at a sports metaphor.
It's okay.
You know, that's, you don't carry, there has to be a pass somewhere. The storyteller has, I think the storyteller has obligation to plant seeds. You know. I take that back. Storytellers have no obligation, yeah. Right? They're getting paid. They tell stories.
They have obligation to do whatever the producer's telling them to.
Yeah. I think a real visionary and good storyteller, I think their role is to plant seeds. And they're going to be coming from the worldview they're coming from. But if they really want to do it, even if it's Transformers, or whether it's Shawshank Redemption, right? I mean, the goal is to put in a few seeds and ideas that you could have some conversation about. Like, what if technology became self-aware? Mm-hmm. Like that's a great conversation. If you leave the movie Terminator or Terminator 2 or were there others? I don't know.
Terminator 3.
Were there? I don't remember. I don't think some people don't want to remember if there was others. But if you leave that, if you just leave and sort of clear your throat and go home, that has momentary value. It has no lasting value. Like, the great conversations were over late night coffee where it's just like, what if this happened? Or what would you do? Or what if, you know, that's what really makes things interesting.
What does it even mean to be self-aware?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And that's the new Battlestar Galactica pursued some of that too. Mm-hmm. It's like, all right, if machines have become sentient, so like, why do we have inalienable? Why do we have certain rights? Why do we say we are created? Are we created equal? Where is equal apart from being created or objective value? Like, all those great conversations come out of that, and that's where, I mean, that's why that has fascinated me for two decades, and it's been fun to see other people get fueled by that conversation and to be able to re-engage that, because I think it's just something we lost. And culturally now we have so much. We can just skip. It's like the kid who's always got his mouth full and never stops to say, "Wow, that tasted awesome." Like, you never turn to your friend and actually share, "That tasted awesome. Did you pick out the notes?" You know, you think about wine tasting or scotch or you know, chocolate, whatever it is. So if you're tasting and sampling, like, storytelling is supposed to involve that component where you appreciate the notes and the nodes, and you're comparing it with somebody across the table who maybe points out, "Oh, I didn't think about it that way. I see that in it now." You take another taste. And storytelling ought to be like fine dining. And, you know, but speaking for myself, we're Americans and we're used to a culture of fast food snacking all the time.
And that's why we have people going to see Grown Ups too. Right?
Is anybody really seeing Grown Ups?
It's selling. Oh. It's making a lot of money. Like, a lot more money than it should. I mean, it's not, you know, outdoing Despicable Me 2 or anything like that, but it's making more money than reason suggests.
Yeah. Yeah, what else you got?
Well, so kind of hitting on that divergence, one of the questions that I see when I do research on what is already out there with film and theology, lots of classes, seminary and stuff, start with the question, how should Christ be represented in film? And they kind of come at it from the trifecta. Should a film that Christians watch show Christ, like a movie of Christ, you know, in figure?
Christ Beazle?
Yeah. Should it be what we typically get with the kind of fireproofs, the courageous kind of movies where the surfer, Soul Surfer, I believe, the ones that are, you know, Christian produced and they're so blatant with their Christian message that almost nothing is, you know, it's almost impossible to be real. Mm-hmm. Or should we do the kind of Tolkien approach and have truths about Christ woven into good storytelling? I mean, like, it sounds like you would be in the third camp. But I mean, like, do you see that there's value in each of those?
I have a hard time, you know, I have a hard time with Christ in movies. I mean, I enjoyed, actually do. I own Passion of the Christ. It has some value to me.
Mm-hmm.
And it certainly was a pivotal cultural impact at its time. So I don't know how many times we need to try to revisit that and come up with the most ever more faithful version.
From our new notes that we've gotten.
Right. Yeah. Although, you know, I mean, it's, you know, if we go from Tobey Maguire to Andrew Garfield, I guess if we're, you know, there's really no statute of limitations on reboots these days, so.
Reboot the gospel.
Yeah. So we could move on from Jim Caviezel to the next. But I do think we don't need to keep, that story is out there. And today it's out there in so many different ways. I don't need know that we need to try to recreate that specifically. And I really don't like the, you know, I suppose I'm not excited about doing, you know, modernized Shakespeare versions of the gospel story. I've never seen it done well. If you're going to change anything, I mean, if you even get into, look at Aslan, as great as Aslan is, there's some elements and some things that he said that obviously it's C.S. Lewis, aping, lioning, you know, is Jesus in many ways, but people spend almost too much time debating certain lines that were said, and does that truly line up exactly biblically? Is Aslan just like Jesus? Well, maybe that's a problem. Maybe that's a waste of time. We're talking about, did we get the character close enough versus actually talking about the consequences of the story itself and how they line up with the real thing. Let's talk about the real deal. And so I don't get excited about trying to do that. In fact, I actually like the fact, in retrospect, that the Matrix steered further and further away from having Neo be exactly like Jesus. First movie, whole lot of very significant parallels. And then even I, at the time, was kind of disappointed the further and further it got away. At the same time, think about it. He's in our real... it was put in on Earth in the future where machines have taken over. Well, that would be a future of our world where there was already a literal Christ. And my timeline and my chronology. I mean, we could go back in time and blow up Vulcan and change everything, but... right? You could do that, but so he should be at best an archetype, but none of the archetypes look exactly right. I mean, you roll back before Jesus in the big Bible story, and Moses doesn't look exactly like him. David doesn't look exactly like him. Like there's foreshadowing slices, and then there's failures and fallibilities that look nothing. Like no one should look like Christ except Christ. So let's not waste time trying to come up with the perfect Christological metaphor. Let's see, I know you're not a Superman fan. Maybe we don't need somebody who looks that, you know, maybe it in itself is also problematic. I may concede that.
Well, but there's still a lot there. I mean, because we never say that he's Christ, but at the same time, it really gets people talking about the fact. So maybe just the fact that the conversation gets started, whether it's a perfect archetype or not, is still valuable.
It did. I loved that it was all over the media. It made for some fun conversations with friends, even for myself. So I loved that finally people got, I mean, over the years, I think it's been a rolling accumulation of messianic similarities. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was punctuated in 79 with sort of Marlon Brando's unerring soliloquy. So I think that's been a rolling thing that's now had its cultural impact. And, you know, maybe we don't need to keep trying to refine him to get him just right. So maybe if people love Superman more, they'll come to Christ. I'm not sure that's how it works, but
probably a couple more dots in that line.
Yeah. But I mean, even a film like Gran Torino, I mean, in some ways, very, very obvious, but extremely well performed. But you had this element of sacrifice, and yet again, showed it at a church, and a lot of people freaked out because of all the four-letter words.
Yeah.
And yet we actually got friends and people to come to talk about this story and talk about why that kind of sacrifice is a good thing. I mean, if you know, that's a valid question. And again, what is humanity and what and why is sacrifice even a value in a subjective world? So we're still getting to those conversations. So the fireproofs, I don't think they're bad, but they generally do. I've seen some of them bunt at the end, and people walk away with the idea that Christendom is all about wholesome, healthy living. And not so much walk away really getting that we're talking about a very imminent, real, personal relationship with the creator of the universe and the ways that he has interacted with us. And if they're not walking away from those stories with anything, if they're still walking away thinking that Christianity is about rules mm-hmm. and religion and ritual and just being good people, then I'd rather just mix it up. I'd rather be in the culture, but not, I'd rather mix and mingle our people in with, you know, Christians, non-Christians, whatever. Let's mix in a few dozen other categories, mix them all together in a potpourri, and let's be seeding the relationships that are telling those stories. First of all, the cool thing about movies, I think more than any other medium that I can think about in history, I mean, the most laborious thing is watching credits, and the most beautiful thing is watching credits. I mean, old plays took a lot of people. Like, storytelling many times is just in the hands of one person and maybe an editor, or over the campfire, it's in the hands of one person. Mm-hmm. You do a book, you've got some other hands and fingers in the pie. You go all the way up, even television, be it larger and larger crews up to making cinema in every aspect, from IT to the actors, to the directors, to the screenwriters, to all the Hollywood people who then ruin the screenplay. You know, there's so many hands on that. It's, if I'm a Christian in that environment and I want to have an influence, so I can, one, I got an influence on relationships. The more those relationships are influenced, I think more naturally it's going to seep into the storytelling. Sure, as I'm working on and in and around some of the screenplays or the acting, or I'm talking and being involved with the characters and the directors, there might be choices and other things that influence the stories or modify that. If I'm getting screenplays published, then I have a pretty significant influence. But again, the ending could get changed. Things mm-hmm. can get muddled. If my goal is to get it right, as if the truth of God rests on the final product being perfect, then we miss the point.
Yep.
We miss the point. God always gets much out of our muddle. And he showed everywhere that what we've produced falls short just points to the need for him. As I love, the more stories create conversations of how even the best character still kind of falls short. Or we're even potentially the worst character. Or maybe in a really muddy film where it's hard to tell the difference. The need for conversation about the need for something more never emerges better.
Yeah, that in and of itself is almost a better conversation than, was he exactly like Christ in this movie?
Yeah, I mean, in my book, I talk about that kind of, I do polarize, and I don't want to be so reductionistic that there's only two stories, but there is one story. It's very much the hero's journey and the monomyth and the adventures of Luke Skywalker or the John Carter, poor John Carter in his movie. That's a great book. Hey, anybody listening to the podcast, read the old, centuries old books. That's the best plug I can give for this whole thing. is man, Edgar Rice Burroughs really wrote us the template for almost every science fiction fantasy. Maybe be clear, the sci-fi fantasy stories that we've read for the last century, they're all in there. If you read that, you might hate all other movies for the last century for just really plagiarizing him. So maybe you shouldn't read it. But either way, that movie made me cry.
But not for the right reasons.
Yeah, for all the wrong reasons. But I was talking about something. I was talking about there's hero's journey stories, and I love them very much. They excite me. They're the staple I've had since I was a kid. But I really like the stories that almost leave you with a sense of hopelessness or life is meaningless. And it's really, as an early Christian, Ecclesiastes really spoke to me because I needed to understand the negative quotient, the apart, like, what does it really mean? I was sort of raised in a church and in a pretty wholesome family. Even though we're poor and didn't live in the best neighborhood, I never really felt safe. I felt safe, and I never truly wanted. I never truly needed anything. I wanted a lot of things, but mm-hmm. I wanted the Star Wars Cantina playset. But my needs were met, and so I was like, and I had a loving relationship, so life felt like it had a meaning, and it was really that sense stories. I really needed to get away from my jaded, cynical, entitled self and start engaging stories where we just peel back the layers of, yeah, what does it mean to be human? So my favorite film's Blade Runner. Mm-hmm. You're dealing with, you know, Harrison Ford in a great performance with Rutger Hauer and the connection between them about what meaning does life have. It if especially if it ends and the end is truly the end, then it's all meaningless. If all these things are going to be lost in time, like tears and rain, and that's what's going to happen. And bubbles up even again. It's actually what's bothered me about Highlander, a lot of vampire stories, bubbled up again in the Wolverine, is the idea that the eternal life doesn't. It's almost like life is meaningful because it's fleeting. And like, what are you talking about? Like the eternal life has meaning. If my life's eternal, then what I do here echoes in eternity. That's the Gladiator call. And so you see, even from Gladiator to, you know, we just jumped genres and styles and silliness to, but all those films are connected because they're talking about meaning. And I needed to visit that angsty side. Hey, I was a teenager. I was also like 30 when I was a teenager, but like, I needed to visit that side and really get a grasp for that. And I think it lends itself maybe to more of the conversations that we need. Maybe the hero's journey or the stories, we need right now, but not the... No, now I'm going to the dark narrow. It's not working.
You're never going to get that.
It's just stories we deserve, not the stories we need.
I'm doing my Batman voice, but no one else is around.
I think there's a day. I do think there's a day, someday, and I think it's in a kingdom to come, where we won't need... like horror stories will be unnecessary. And stories that end with life is meaningless, or what my friend Greg affectionately calls the You Lose Ending movies, which are rare in Hollywood, but sometimes really poignant, where like the character bleeds out at the end, or the earth gets destroyed at the end. The things that again, we mentioned Twilight Zone. Mm-hmm. Twilight Zone would have you lose endings all the time. It was always that dun-dun-dun moment where it's like, oh, everything you thought was wrong, and you're screwed. In fact, the thing you did to save today is actually the thing that ruins it. And those stories are pivotal, because now I go out talking. What if my whole life's endeavor actually leads to the ruination of everything I hold dear? Those are the ones that really get us thinking. I can go home placated by a hero story and forget about the fact that it's fiction for a moment and just feel good that there's heroes out there. When there's hopelessness, I think they're great. And on that same time, hopelessness and horror stories, it'd be great if we didn't need them, but I think they're essential.
It makes us ask the questions. And without it, we just assume everything would work out right all the time.
Yeah.
Superman's always going to show up and save us.
Well, only if you're a reporter in a short skirt.
That's right. Everybody else, you're with the building. But, well, I think that kind of gives us a really good idea. Hopefully anyone who was not aware is better informed now. And so I want to transition to kind of give it a slightly lighter mood, to just ask fun questions.
All right.
Well, I think you may have mentioned it, but it's just a guess. But what is your favorite film?
Favorite film is Blade Runner.
Yeah.
Although it's followed up closely by The Empire Strikes Back. And followed up, I think, shortly on the top 10 list by Raiders of the Lost Ark. So,
which I could have guessed by the posters here in your nerd cave.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I also do... there's always the question, does a trilogy count?
Mm-hmm.
It's like my wife Kat would be like, well, do I have to say Fellowship of the Ring or Two Towers? Can I just say the Lord of the Rings trilogy? Mm-hmm. Can I say the Star Wars trilogy?
Well, but then you're talking about story. Obviously, there's something like in the overarching story. So I think if they're continuous, it should count.
Yeah.
And if it's not continuous, then maybe you might have to get a mulligan on that one.
So there's a contender for the throne, and that's honestly the Dark Knight trilogy. It's still very fresh, and it's going to take me a decade before I would knock the top slot out of its top slot. So it still goes to Blade Runner at this point, but Christopher Nolan to me is one of the finest filmmakers of our age. And so what Ridley Scott was doing in 1982, in many ways, Nolan to me is a visual and storytelling successor in some ways.
So since you just put yourself in a hole by naming a number of movies instead of just one, can you link some kind of theme? Like, what is it about these movies? Or is there one thing about these movies that is prevalent in every single one that is speaking to you? I mean, like, that makes it your favorite. Because, I mean, the concept is when almost like reading the Bible, though, once again, I would not say that any film is as powerful as the Bible. When we read, like, there are certain things in every story that jump out. You can, you know, hand people the same book of the Bible, they can read it, and you have a conversation later. Two different things that they really focused on. So there's something in these movies that are grabbing James's attention.
I can't be certain, but I think that there is an element in all those films. Empire Strikes Back is the, like, even Empire Strikes Back's the one movie that ends, like, it doesn't end well. And yet I didn't leave the theater thinking, I didn't leave the theater truly thinking there'd be no resolution. I was a little nervous that I had to wait 3 years for the resolution. So they didn't film them back to back like they do now. But I remember as a kid, there was some joy, there was some success, but like a character lost a hand and maybe I'd never see Han Solo again. Except that he would become Indiana Jones. So there was a mixture and things got turned on its head. Like here, the hero's father was actually the villain. So there was brokenness in the family. And so even there, even as an 8-year-old, there was something intriguing about that to me that's lingered for the rest of my life. Blade Runner in the same way, as we talked about it, there is by the time I actually was really into it, when I was in college, they actually had the two versions. So now it's like, all right, it's this bleak movie with maybe a hopeful ending or maybe not, depending on which ending you watch. So there was, again, that mixture of hope and hopelessness. And the Dark Knight trilogy takes you on that roller coaster ride really well and really splits the line. The first film, Batman Begins, is very much the hero's journey. Dark Knight, it absolutely takes everyone, including Batman, everyone throws them into compromise. And the only way to fix it is by fabricating a false story. There's not really a lot of hope there. And the third movie then brings that back to haunt them and then does bring about some resolution, but if there is some hope and there is some happiness, it's still juxtaposed with some bitterness. And so I think, honestly, that probably ties back to the Tolkien-esque thing that my wife likes, which is he told a story, which in some way there are heroes on the road. But Frodo's journey is extremely arduous, fraught with suffering, and it feels real. And Empire Strikes Back might not have that in its fullness, but as an 8-year-old, I could sense, even in the fanciful flight, that there was darkness. Mm-hmm. And I think it better reflects the catch I find myself in now. I mean, I live with a promise, I believe, that God has both birthed an amazing story and also sent a sufficient savior. And yet we're still in this place between the now and not yet, where like I have hope, but there are days when life kind of sucks. And there are days when it's the ring is heavy. There are days when I'm not sure if I'm going to see a certain friend again. There are days when people's lives stop. And even those questions to haunt me, the doubt tries to creep in. What if that is it? What if I don't see them again? What if there is no kingdom to come? Or what if they aren't there to share it? There's a lot of that heaviness. So that didn't take us to a lighter place, man. Come on.
I know. I was really trying.
I'm the no fun guy right now.
Oh, goodness.
Oh.
Okay.
We got to get happy.
Well, how about we suggest that maybe if the Dark Knight trilogy, instead of Christian Bale, maybe starred Harrison Ford, it would shoot to the top?
I think definitely.
That would be the deal.
We've well established, my man crush is documented in poster form. So
the one actor to bind them all? okay, well, something that hopefully will let your inner nerd, and I guess outer nerd.
All right.
I once again think I know what the answer to this question is, having visited your nerd cave.
Okay.
But who, actually, let me back up. You, much like myself, big Star Trek fan.
Okay.
Who is your favorite captain?
Captain Kirk, definitely.
Now, nerd away. Why? Why Kirk?
Well, I think when I was a kid, I loved him because he's, in a lot of ways, pure id. Now I get psychological. There's a whole other, and this still, it's not dark. Maybe it's not light, but it's not dark.
Don't make this depressing.
I won't. No. I think, I didn't know as a kid. I loved Kirk, but he had a couple buddies to keep him in check. That's as simple as I saw it then. Like, he had you know, somebody grousing on one side of him and somebody talking endless reason on the other side. And he just wanted to surge forward and run and take the hill and climb the tree. And so there was something adventurous about him that I loved. Come to realize later, those two things tempered him. If you almost look at, I think the reason they're the most enduring and why now we've circled all the way back and now have a brand new Star Trek with Kirk, Spock, and McCoy is you kind of have a trio. Not saying they're the Star Trek's holy trinity, because they don't really work as father, son,
but
holy
you
ghost.
Are.
They don't work as father, son, and ghost. Like there's, and although you know the characters have a habit of dying and coming back, but no, Kirk definitely has that impulsive id, and then he's got sort of reason to keep it in check, and he's got the superego. He's got the curmudgeon and the cynic that sort of keeps there's three aspects. I really think that three of them are just one person. And as we watch the story, you see how the three, you know, the pieces of us think through things and walk through life. And usually one of them usually gets the upper hand in the conversation. And sometimes that's good and sometimes that's bad. And so there's something fun about that scenario to where you're watching what could be three friends that keep each other in check. But a lot of the wrestling is wrestles we're all very familiar with just internally as we run through life. And the idea of exploration, the idea of adventuring and I like Kirk because, like Kirk, we're both incredibly good looking. So, there's a sense of ego. There's definitely something in Kirk that I've always loved that I have to constantly also be repenting of. Because that ego is pretty unchecked. But now, like William Shatner, we both need a toupee. So, and there's some similarities there. I'm really more of a Picard guy when it comes to the
actual look,
the hair.
For the cosplay, you are Picard?
Yeah, it's sad but true. We're actually just talking about that, having a Star Trek-themed event, and I'm probably saddled with being Picard.
So you're not going to just try to power through and with the old uniform and do it? You're actually going to... I don't want to say settle, because I'm a Picard guy.
Okay. Why Picard? I don't know.
Sir Patrick Stewart. I mean,
that's
like,
true.
I love
I'm a Sir Patrick Stewart guy, but see, he can also be Xavier.
Well... The Xavier we haven't seen yet, or the CGI Xavier, because those are hopefully two different Xaviers. But I mean, like Picard to me is strong. He's he's a man of conviction. He's a strong leader, and he probably reminds me a lot of men in my life when I was younger, with the side that I never saw. You know, they're strong, commanding, but. Especially once you get into like seasons 3 and 4 of The Next Generation, you start to see that he is probably one of the most caring individuals in the entire show. You know, he doesn't let his emotions rule him, but he is almost always thinking about someone besides himself.
I'll give you that. It was and a couple decades later, no one can argue that there were certain elements of characterization and the freedom of television made... his character was able to be a lot more compelling.
Well, I mean, one of the things that I always noticed when I watched The Next Generation was that you basically have almost every single character from the original series just mixed and matched. And, you know, you have the Data Spock, you have Riker, who is now the kind of Kirk sexually, except apparently somewhere in like, what, the 24th century or something, like the trombone becomes very sexy. I don't know when the trombone becomes sexy.
It will never.
I think that's why it's science fiction.
That's why it's an alternate timeline.
So hopefully that lightens the mood in general. But again, I want to thank you. I was hoping just to get a little bit of your time, and you've given me way more of your time than I probably deserve. So it's that time where, James...
Yeah?
If people have loved what you've said here, or people just hate it and want to, you know, prove that man is awful and send you flame comments and of the YouTube variety for some reason, how can they get a hold of you? What are you doing these days that people can kind of follow you, get on board with what you're doing?
Well, they can go to cinemagog.com. I tried to come up with a website that was, you know, most people couldn't spell because that means they can't get there. But if you fuse cinema and synagogue into some strange hybrid of a word, you'll get there. So give it a shot. And then also, I mean, I'm on Facebook, pretty easily find us. Just look up James Harlan. There's not a lot of us. Facebook.com/Harlemanic, not Harlemaniac. which would also be apt, but Harlem Manic, as in Manic Depressive. You can find me there or on Twitter. Same thing, Harlem Manic. We're there.
You put it on a downer again?
Oh.
Gosh.
No, but it's the manic. It's the good side, right? That's, oh, wait, that's not how it works.
Nope. Well, once again, thank you so much, and I hope everyone's enjoyed the first interview, hopefully of a number that I will get to do over time. And I guess until next time, remember that entertainment is not mindless.
I'd say till all are one, which is a line from Transformers the movie, but it's a pagan concept, so no.
Bye-bye.